If you're on the net, there is a way to participate in a class that is not available to Google Hard on the net. I'm pursuing a proper processing to have Ethernet jack turned on at this point, so long as your laptop with a $20 Ethernet card registered, you'll be able to participate as well. And I wanted to show how it works and see if this is a good complement to raising your hand, opening a class, getting your view, and then continuing. Is there an easy way to have people check this out? Is that a certain site?
/is99/app.
So if you go to cyber.raw.harvard.edu/is99/app, those of you who are connected, /app, and you see a question and comment submission system. There's $1 of work. And as a form that appears, you can type in your first name, last name, email, address, subject, type in your comment, and click submit. So why don't you just try that? Anybody who has managed to get the ask page, go ahead, type in your comment, and click submit. Remember, you're doing this at this point. Who's going to have Ethernet? Come on. All right, so we think we have one now. That, of course, has disappeared. Ben? So how do we now see the comment? Plan B, of course, is for Vectorbomb. This is a paper passing on the front of the manual out. There are currently two outstanding Tom Red and Bill's Not a Comment from Bill Banks from the Great Township and Phenomenal Carizo, right?
Yeah.
Work and comment. So this is your way. You know your inbox, it's on board of Cookie Bingo, stuff is happening, you just find out your phone has to use when you listen. And then you actually feel you've got something to say about what's being said, and yet you're not really to raise your hand and say it. Now you can say it, click submit, and then at some key moment it will be worked into the flow of the class as it goes. So it'll be worked up. Give us in a whirl during the rest of the day, and we will really recognize comments that just happen. If you don't do this, there won't be any comments. This will be unfortunate. Okay, so that's the comments. With that, then, I'm going to turn to the guests we have today, some of whom are guests within this room. How many people here hail from MIT? Welcome. You have successfully infiltrated our Harvard Law School class, and we're delighted to have you. And then I'm so delighted that there was a reception afterwards. We managed to incorporate that reception with drinks. and other students, I think we're going to be using that door at critical moments, so please plan to stay after class for medical PETA and other students, courtesy of our department. With that, why don't I introduce Danny Weissner? Danny Weissner is somebody I met probably 6, 7 years ago, and probably needs to make for a long time. He's quite an expert on such things. He's been out in Washington doing interviews sort of through TV, and then in cascading DNS fashion, introduced people to his left and to his right, and sort of take away. So, Danny,
great. Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you on behalf of all of us. MIT folks, thanks for having us all. As most of you, I'm sure, know, this is the first joint meeting of two classes that are happening here in Cambridge on internet policy issues. One is happening at MIT that I'm co-teaching with Hal Abelson and Mike Fisher, and the other is happening here. And we've happily been able to coordinate our schedule so that we can all meet together a couple times on Thursdays during the semester. I don't actually have the privilege of teaching full time. I have a day job. I'm head of the technology and society domain at the World Wide Web Consortium, which means that I spend most of my time worrying about the development of technical standards for the web that have legal or public policy implications. And I'm especially happy that for today's class we have two real experts in this field. To my left is Alan Davidson. Alan is the staff counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. He's really one of the leading experts on cryptography policy in Washington in either the commercial world or the nonprofit world. And
there are only two of us, so
not much. But you are one of the leading two. Alan really is someone who people in Washington, whatever their political stripes or persuasions, look to for sound thoughts on this issue. And beneath this kind-looking exterior is also really a very vigorous lobbyist, and he's been working on behalf of civil liberties interests on this issue for a number of years, since I made the dramatic mistake of hiring him at the Center for Democracy and Technology when I was there. But it's great to have Alan here. We have also Jonah Steiger from Mindshare Internet Campaigns. When the history of internet politics and lobbying is written, there'll be a sort of a catchy line somewhere about the transition in status symbols from Gucci shoes to G3 Max, and Jonah will, I think, be the prime example of that transition. But Jonah really has been for a number of years a pioneer in developing unique and new ways of using the internet as a political force, in using the tools that the net and the web offer to organize online political campaigns. He's worked on Communications Decency Act lobbying, and he's here today because he's had really a leading role in helping to shape the voice of the net in the cryptography policy debate. So now perhaps, Jonathan, you can introduce the class and my alter ego.
Well, yeah, all I hope to have today, James Kostrom, we all know from the TWA Flight 800 tragedy, assistant director on the Federal Bureau of Investigation, College of Surveillance, and Surveillance. He now, of course, has another job as vice president of NVMA, the people that send all of you platinum, titanium, and chromium, and credit card offers, and all of you labels. So he uses his former skills to ferret out every last person on the planet who has not yet been offered in platinum, right? We have to invite him, so he's not here. But Danny might be able to role play a little bit, and for purposes of at least the next 5 to 10 minutes, actually be and channel James Kostrom, and on behalf of the law enforcement and perhaps national security community, as to why they care so much about encryption. And indeed, James, why do you care so much about
Jonathan, it's a dangerous world out there. And it's dangerous for reasons that we all know. It's dangerous. It's a dangerous world, and the job of the FBI and other law enforcement agencies around the world is increasingly difficult, increasingly challenging, because of several trends that I think you all recognize. Number one, there is an undisputed globalization of crime. I'm going to find out who wrote whatever that was. there's an unquestionable globalization of crime. Crime, whether it be drug crime, terrorism, narco-terrorism, money laundering, occurs across borders today, and criminals have the sophistication to conduct their operations in such a way that they take advantages of the weaknesses that law enforcement has in crossing national borders. In addition to this global threat, there are very dramatic threats to our nation's critical infrastructures, to our electric power infrastructure, to our water infrastructure, to our telecommunications infrastructures. And these threats are perpetrated by sophisticated rings of criminals and terrorists who use the most sophisticated technology to put our very basic public services at risk. And I think that it's hard for some of you probably to imagine just how close to the brink of collapse some of these public services are at any moment, based on the very real threats that are going on today as we speak. I'm proud to be able to say that that our law enforcement establishment is working hard to keep up with these threats, but we really face a very fundamental stumbling block. We face an army, really, of profit-driven high technology industry, computer companies, security companies, networking companies, and a small but very vocal band of civil libertarian extremists, well-meaning, people who represent a view of our society and our constitution that is can only be described as radical in their advocacy that people somehow in this country, citizens of this country, have a right to absolute privacy. They're making an unprecedented claim in the history of our country that citizens ought to be able to conduct communications activities, association, under the veil of absolute secrecy. And I don't have to tell, especially some of you in this class, how formidable the latest computer security and encryption technologies are against any kind of surveillance. But I think that you can anticipate, you can appreciate that it is the technology change that has put in people's hands the ability to have a kind of absolute privacy to cover their affairs that we really have never before seen. And we in the law enforcement community are really only concerned with preserving our current capabilities to conduct electronic surveillance, to use the very important tools of wiretapping and other surveillance techniques to enable us to do our job to protect the citizens of this country against a very serious array of threats that are emerging in this world.
Well, there are about 50 or 60 different reasons, but I'll give you a top couple. First of all, I think the top one is that there's a new medium in town, the internet. One of the most inherently insecure and unsafe mediums for people who use it that we've seen so far. And what I mean by that is the packets that we send around, the messages that we send around the internet, travel like postcards. Even just the message being sent from a computer in this room to the computers up here may go through 5 or 6 different machines on campus. A message sent from New York to Geneva might travel through 10 different computers in 10 different countries on its way. And each one of the stops along the way, it travels as plain text. Anybody along the way, it's basically technically trivial to read the text of those messages messages sent between those computers at any stop along the way. And it's not just messages that are being read by law enforcement, could be read by law enforcement agents or other people or hackers or potential criminals here in the United States. It's being done in other countries as well where we don't have the same kind of rules or laws that we have to protect information. There's no Fourth Amendment outside of the borders of the United States to protect information or protect us from secret searches or searches and seizures of information. So we've got this incredibly insecure network where data travels around like a postcard. Enter encryption. Encryption is the tool that enables people to protect their data and ensures that that the only people who read the data are the intended recipients are the people who have access to the keys to unlock it. And so in this new decentralized network where data travels around and you can't predict where it's going to go and you can't predict who's going to be able to see it along the way, encryption is this essential tool to protecting information. So people are going to need encryption to be able to protect their email messages, but also their very sensitive information that is increasingly finding its way online, financial transaction, prescription information, sensitive information that we put on our notebooks or send to our loved ones. Businesses need it to be able to protect the infrastructure for e-commerce, and our nation actually needs encryption for some of the same reasons that Danny mentioned or James mentioned, that we need to be able to protect our infrastructure, which is increasingly finding its way online, our banking system, our financial system, our utilities, now being run through the network in a very insecure way right now. So encryption enables to harden that infrastructure and protect it. And we need it actually to protect public safety. And just two quick points on the perceived threat to law enforcement. We live today in what is probably the golden age of wiretapping. In today's world, there's no way that any conversation can go unlistened to, that any phone conversation can be tapped. Our financial transactions, our ATM records, our Visa card bills create this incredible wealth of surveillance information for both governments and for potentially the nefarious elements in all of our lives. And encryption presents the one chance for us in this sea of wiretapping, in this world where once it was possible, maybe say 200 years ago or some period of time ago, to walk into a field and have a conversation with somebody and feel completely secure in the knowledge that that conversation wasn't going to be listened to. Today, it's almost impossible to have those kinds of conversations. But encryption is a technology that provides us with the opportunity to take a little privacy back for individuals in a world where that privacy is being eroded.
Now, interestingly, both of you so are appealing to a status quo of recent vintage that you sound like you like. You're saying, look, the world today is one that's far less secure, far less able to keep secrets than the world yesterday, so we need encryption to help lock it up. And the FBI view has been, wait a minute, the world today is one that's on the brink of incredibly tight secrets, one that can't be cracked. So we need to go back to the world. The FBI, the key expert,
we should talk about why we are in, as Alan says, the golden age of wiretapping. First, let's point out that there are fewer than 1,500 wiretaps done per year. So, lest Mr. Davidson scare you all into his radical views, let's remember that it's relatively unlikely that any of you ever have been the target of a wiretap, ever will be the target of a wiretap. We're talking about 1,500 taps per year at most. And let's talk about why that's the case, why that's possible. That's possible in some significant part because a few years ago, the Congress recognized that the balance between the development of technology, of these advanced communications technologies, digital communications technologies, and law enforcement's legitimate needs to conduct electronic surveillance was slipping out of whack. So the Congress passed the Communications Assistant for Law Enforcement Act, CALEA, and took a careful look at what that balance should be and set some rules, not just based on whatever the technologists at MIT and elsewhere happen to cook up, but based on what our social values are and what our perceived needs as a society are. We in the law enforcement community are very ready and always have been ready to live within the constitutional boundaries on our activities and the bounds that the Congress puts on our behavior. We're not looking for a lawless world here where we can invade everyone's privacy, but we're looking to make sure that the tools that we depend on are not eliminated by the explosion in technology that's going on.
And let me just say, I think just in response to a couple of pieces there, the numbers on wiretaps actually are growing steadily and actually deceivingly small because there's a lot of other kinds of surveillance that happens besides wiretapping. There are trapped and traces in 10 registers which tell law enforcement what phone calls you've made, what numbers you've dialed. Those happen in much greater numbers than the 1,500 wiretaps. More than that, there are a lot of other kinds of surveillance that happen, subpoenas for documents for things that you've done, subpoenas to your credit card company about what kinds of things you've purchased. Monica Lewinsky her book purchases, records of her book purchases, were subpoenaed by the Ken Starr investigation. So there's lots of different kinds of surveillance that happens in this world. And I guess I should have said that in some ways it's not just the golden age of wiretapping, but it's the golden age of surveillance in a lot of ways that sought to be preserved. And what the FBI is asking for is they're saying, we want to preserve the world that we have today where we can guarantee almost that no conversation can go unlistened to. The notion behind the CALEA statute is to require telephone companies to build new networks in ways that allow for wiretapping to happen even if they would have built the networks in a way that wouldn't have allowed wiretapping. So the idea is to say, we want to preserve and create a world where every conversation can be tapped into, no matter what conversation it is, whether it happens on the internet, whether it happens over a telephone, whether it's something that's data that's stored on my machine that I try and encrypt and keep secret. The FBI has asked for a backdoor into all of that information.
Now, they're still asking for a strict legal process, right? Most of the examples you gave, even the Ken Starr investigation, came with a subpoena, which meant that something legal process was involved for recognition of data. Now, on the internet, if I use a new internet phone application so that I'm speaking with one of your computers and going over the net and arriving out the other end at somebody else's computer, do the FBI need wiretap authority?
Actually, they do need wiretap authority today to do that in the United States. One particularly troublesome issue about this, of course, is that the internet is not just a national medium, it's a global medium. So the question becomes, even if we said, well, gee, we might feel comfortable with the idea that in the United States we have a Fourth Amendment, we have these legal standards that protect information. The question is, how does that standard apply outside of the United States? What happens in countries where the same sort of tradition of protection from surveillance by anybody doesn't exist? And so to say that it's okay because we have these legal protections in the United States begs the question of how the medium is supposed to operate, what happens to encryption keys, what happens to information outside of the United States. And for example, I should have said one of the applications that encryption is increasingly being used for is by human rights activists all around the world who use encryption to protect information in life or death settings, literally, where the threat is in fact a repressive government. And the idea that there might be national legal protections that would safeguard access to the encryption really doesn't do much good.
So I still want to turn around shortly and hear how key escrow might fit into a possible compromise between the two views that have been expressed here. But I also understand from signaling from that we have remote comment that may bear on this. For instance, the world is so dangerous, and we need the FBI to protect us. Who is going to protect us from the FBI, especially outside the U.S.? How might this question to the FBI?
The Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects U.S. citizens against law enforcement abuses, and we believe that's worked well over the years. We train our agents extensively in the legal rules and procedures. The process, you all may not appreciate this, the process for obtaining a wiretap order is a tremendously lengthy process. It originates with the local U.S. attorney. It has to travel up through the Justice Department to a special office in Washington, which reviews each application with a great deal of scrutiny. The entire process is supervised by a U.S. District Court judge. So, the FBI doesn't conduct electronic surveillance outside the United States.
In theory. In theory. Right. Well, one thing is that there's an open question about exactly what kind of surveillance is being done outside of the United States. That involves people who are not U.S. citizens. There's a great deal of surveillance that happens even by U.S. intelligence agencies outside of the United States directed at people who are not U.S. citizens. Right.
When the U.S. government receives requests for electronic surveillance assistance from foreign governments, we follow exactly the same process as with U.S. citizens, regardless of who the requesting agency is.
But the National Security Agency
is legally barred from conducting surveillance inside the United States. Correct.
And I mean, I think, and part of the problem here is that, you know.
So what's the problem?
I don't know, no problem. And we're forming, we're talking about policy that so far has been U.S. based, and the need to be run as a case study. And then it's start getting into what if the U.S. government wants to be including privacy.
And I can tell you what the problem is. There's a couple of problems, and one of them is for people outside of the United States. That we have a technology that has the potential to enable people outside of the United States and U.S. citizens communicating abroad to protect communications outside of our borders, regardless of the legal regime or lack thereof that your communications may go through. So even, and this is particularly important on the internet, if I'm sending a message to somebody in Paris, that message may go through a country, even if I feel comfortable with the French, with the legal regime in France that protects that communication. It may go through a country where I don't understand the legal regime, and the legal regime doesn't protect my communications. So communications outside of the United States deserve protection, whether they're by U.S. citizens or by non-U.S. citizens, and this is a technology that enables that.
And we have advocated over and over again in this debate to no avail that, of course, people need strong encryption, but but it's important to design that encryption technology in a way that preserves legitimate law enforcement access. We believe that it's possible to do this in a way that protects people in what is clearly a global medium, but still goes as far as possible to guarantee law enforcement access to communications where we have legitimate court supervision. And let me stress, we're under no illusion that we're able to control all of the encryption technology all over the world. There's no question that there will be rogue criminals who will have access to strong encryption technology. But we should not use that as an excuse to just throw up our hands and say that we should live in a society where we encourage all of our citizens and where we provide criminals with easy access to communications capabilities which are fundamentally threatening to the public order.
Well, I'm not going to get into that in a moment, but since we're talking about the little TSO, is that right?
Correct.
What's TSO in a nutshell?
Well, there are a variety of encryption techniques which enable two parties to communicate in a very secure fashion, while at the same time that communication can be decrypted by a third party based on some third party having access to the encryption keys which are necessary to decrypt the communication, so that the two parties and any other party are able to communicate securely without being interfered with by unknown parties. But some third party has the ability to decrypt that communication. We believe that this is a technology which has first and foremost important commercial applications. Companies are not all that likely to want to provide all of their employees perfect secrecy, perfect encryption capabilities for fear that they may leak trade secrets. The employees may leave their positions and then use the information for purposes that would be contrary to the interests of the company. Employees may lose their encryption keys. What happens then? We see lots of reasons in the marketplace for this kind of key escrow or key recovery technology, and we see it being used in a number of situations. Well, what we're simply suggesting is that the industry should work together with law enforcement to preserve the ability to access communications where it is legally authorized.
So this is what I'm saying. The way it would work is you and I, under a key recovery regime, to establish communication that was basically uncrackable by anybody who would happen upon it.
Correct.
However, we have ahead of time found someone that we trust who is blocked by legal process from releasing a certain secret about us. That secret that should release would allow somebody to actually listen in effortlessly to communication that was formerly uncrackable.
Correct.
That's basically how it works.
Correct.
So we typically want to be a court or a separate agency set up for this purpose, or a private party, the way you trust a bank, not keeping its hidden public costs, and they hold it, and that's who law enforcement goes to if they need to, or maybe the company does it.
And this is no different than a normal wiretapping situation. We all of us, every single day, many times a day, trust the telephone company to handle our telephone communications securely. And yes, the telephone company does have the ability, when law enforcement requests it, to provide access to that otherwise very secure communication. On the internet, it is exactly the same thing. We who are AOL subscribers or use another internet service provider trust that service provider to safeguard the security of our communication. But at the same time, those providers are subject to law enforcement process to enable surveillance where it's authorized.
There's a chunk of this that is being left out with this description of cure coverage. It's a fascinating idea, the idea that you can communicate, but you've got to make sure that if you communicate securely, that there's a backdoor that's built in some way, anyway, could be giving, the original iteration of this was you have to give a copy of the key to the federal government. That was the clipper chip idea. A lot of people didn't like that for a variety of reasons, some of which may be evident. The idea of giving your keys to the federal government so they can use them at any time without telling you. But the key feature here is that the key has to be given to a third party so that it can be used to access your information without your knowledge or your consent. And that's a very different kind of system than the kind of system that people might choose to use for themselves. I might take a copy of my house key and give it to the next door neighbor and say, in case I get locked out, okay? But I sure expect that when the painters come and knock on the door, my neighbor is going to say, hey, by the way, the painters came by and they asked for the key. And I can say, wait a second, what painters? I didn't order, I don't have any painters coming. You know. Well, that too, but you know, I think that, I think the point is this notion of notice is central to the quest, to the Fourth Amendment protections that we have today. And it's also central to the issue of key recovery, this requirement that there's got to be a backdoor built in, and it's got to be in a way that law enforcement can get access to it. There's another problem also, which is the same backdoor that allows the government to get in can be exploited by other people to get in. And the idea that it will be, quote unquote, just as secure to use a key recovery system takes a system that is otherwise inherently very secure and adds this backdoor feature into it. And the experts have told us in various reports that, in fact, these systems are less secure. It's much, much harder to build a system that's got this other backdoor built in where there's some big key recovery center out there, some big pile of keys that is held by a bank or by a federal agency. That's going to be a very difficult set of things to protect. And if you're a hacker, you're not actually just going to go after the encrypted information. What you've got now is a big, fat, juicy target out there, which is the key recovery center, the place that holds all the keys. This is like that movie Sneakers, where they discover the key that unlocks all the keys, you know. And so building in this requirement that everybody's got to use a backdoor in any time they want secrecy creates tremendous security problems, and it creates all sorts of privacy problems. And they're talking about using it not just when I'm picking up the phone and trying to make a secure call or when I send email, but when I use encryption for stored information as well. When I take my diary, my personal journal, and encrypt it on my hard drive, the law enforcement system, the FBI, has said that they want to make sure that when I do that encryption on my own little laptop, somehow there's got to be a way that the IP that was used there is also stored with a third party somewhere, so they can get access to that diary without me without telling me.
There's one more voice in this bit. I'm fascinated to hear, by the way, to see my friends, and Danny is doing a fantastic job in representing the FDA. I don't know how your soul is doing, but you're doing a good job.
Jim is a good friend.
There's one voice in this debate that's not being represented here, and just for the sake of it, I'm going to throw in the mix that this is not happening in the abstract. This is happening in the context of a growing computer industry with a global market that's trying to sell its products to both customers in the United States and around the world. And I guess since I represent them in this debate, I'll try to do their side justice in approaching. They are companies like Microsoft and Novell and America Online and AT&T and MCI and many, many others that have, there's an important point about the key escrow debate that goes to something that Mr. Kallstrom said, which is that although there may be some market value for key recovery or key escrow products, we haven't really seen the demand for it. And the market is not clamoring for us as an industry to develop products with built-in backdoors. There may be some specific cases in large corporate networks or other places where very customized systems require this kind of service, but the consumer marketplace, the shrink-wrap software marketplace, is not asking for this. And in fact, they're afraid of it. There was a recent story in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago about some computer scientists who, digging around in one of Microsoft's products, found a line of code that said NSA.key. It happened to be some totally unrelated function to cryptography, but when this came out, Microsoft had a major PR problem from a lot of people thinking that, in fact, they had made a deal with the NSA. And so if the market were demanding these products, we might be more sympathetic to the law enforcement arguments, but we're not. Another problem, just to throw it out here, is that the industry is trying to sell its products to a global market. And the FBI's vision of how to solve this problem is tying our hands and ceding some of the United States' competitive advantage in the global market in the high technology industry to companies in countries like Germany and Israel and even the former Soviet Union. So while they're debating about some very important privacy and security considerations, we as an industry are sort of stuck here trying to develop products to meet a global demand for security and so far at least have been stuck in this policy morass.
The export controls would say you can't export anything.
That's correct.
You know, I think that somehow as we as a society face the introduction of this really dramatically new medium, as Alan said, we have to be able to work together to identify ways that we can preserve our basic values. Jonah is correct. If there were no export controls, his clients could sell more products. You may well be correct that any individual company on its own does not need exactly the kind of key recovery technology that we hope will become popular. But I think you'd agree that we all do need a society with some basic level of public safety in order to function. And we somehow all have to think about what it means to live in the world that these two gentlemen are advocating. From a law enforcement perspective, we find it quite alarming.
I think, actually, unfortunately, what's been a little disingenuous, I think, about the FBI's argument has been the fact that, you know, that planes will fall from the sky that the world will come to an end if people start using strong encryption. The fact is that even in a world where people have access to these important tools, there's going to be a lot of possibilities for the law enforcement to do its job. I mean,
you can always run into somebody who comes up and blow out the secret.
Sure.
Or something.
Right.
your story is also an amniotic story, that if we manage through careful use of technology, create a scheme that roughly approximates the degree of security you have in your house. You don't have to give the federal government a copy of your key, because they don't need it if they want to sneak into your house and not have any results, right? Unless you've got a lock that...
Very good lock, right.
Exactly. So, what's the disaster on your side? Isn't that a little bit disingenuous?
No, I think there's a disaster on a couple. Part of the disaster is the notion, accepting the notion that everything should be breakable and everything should be readable, and that we have to then build in these very insecure pieces into our lives. We have to build in this insecurity in order to preserve this very small number of cases where there will be hard problems. There are going to be new hard problems for law enforcement. What I was trying to say is that I think that in many cases, law enforcement will still be able to do its job. For example, I send you an email message. It's encrypted along the way so that nobody can listen in. But when you read it, you have to decrypt it first. And it probably will sit decrypted on your laptop. And there's a new place for law enforcement to come with a subpoena or a proper court order to get the information that they need. When I go to send a message to the Ryder truck company or rent a truck to go blow up a building, that information, the Ryder truck company will turn over their documents to the FBI when the subpoena comes. Those rental records will be available. Just because the communication was encrypted doesn't mean that the information is no longer available. So I think in the vast majority of cases, the FBI and others will be able to get the information they need to make cases, to promote public safety. There are just a few cases which will be harder. There's no question about it. The question is it really worth sacrificing all of our privacy to build this backdoor in, and to sacrifice the privacy of communications outside of the United States that are being used by human rights workers in places like Serbia and Guatemala and Hong Kong and Zaire? Literally, these are places that people are using encryption to protect information from the government. I think that's just
now. The degree to which law enforcement can make use of electronic communication, which they might use for criminal investigations and crime-solving tasks, meaning that be a matter of an arms race, a kind of natural technological development where law doesn't step in. We develop the strongest encryption software we can as a community, it gets deployed, and then $80 million gets plumbed into the FBI to crack it, and then FBI cracks it, more power to them, and then you try to outline it. That's the way to settle the debate.
Well, no, I think that... It's not. I think that that is the path, but that it won't necessarily look like the world that you describe. And in part, I think that's because, I think these systems are very good, and it doesn't turn into an arms race where we spend a lot more money and we crack these systems. Well, I think that we've won something. We will win something. I think actually, in many ways, the battle is being won just by the deployment and use of these technologies by people all around the world in a way that's going to be very difficult to stop. But I think that, what happens though is that, it's not that law enforcement ceases to function or that there won't be new tools. I think the world operates on a certain trajectory. The trajectory, for quite some time, at least within the legal doctrines within the United States, the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence has been a jurisprudence of steady erosion, I think, and many, I think, would objectively argue, steady erosion of the kinds of Fourth Amendment protections that we used to enjoy in this country. In the name of dealing with very serious social problems, such as the war on drugs or other kinds of attempts to stop criminal activity, protect public safety. In that, erosion, in the context of that erosion of Fourth Amendment protections, encryption is kind of like a step function. It's a chance to boost individual privacy, to tip the scales a little in a way that they need to be tipped. I don't think that it will be the end of the discussion. I think there's going to be a lot of possibilities for legal law enforcement activity that are going to continue, and we're going to keep having these conversations. Already the battle over encryption is shifting away from the question about whether we can keep it in the United States, and it's shifting to the question of, in the context of the example of that email that I sent to you, under what circumstances, if we can't get at the encryption, under what circumstances can we get the plain text? That's the next frontier.
So The answer is another phase of things. We're going to talk about what happened last Thursday to change some of the boundaries made, and talk with Roosevelt too, a little bit about how the actual sovereignty made on Capitol Hill and elsewhere to actually create policy on this. And you guys all agree with the trenches on that. But before we do, why don't we clear out comments that are both here and there.
I think one was the thing to be sort of dismissed. And if you're building into the law that, oh, you can't have strong encryption, does that mean you can't have expectation of privacy, and therefore we don't have a Fourth Amendment protection?
I think that the our understanding of the legal expectation of privacy has always had both a subjective and an objective component, and importantly, especially when faced with new technology, we've always had to wrestle with the question as a society, what level of privacy should people be entitled to expect? I can say, well, I expect perfect privacy. I don't care what you think. But at some point, my expectation runs right headlong into the public safety and the general public interest in having an orderly society. So we can't avoid answering that question, I believe, from a policy perspective. The law enforcement community ultimately will live with the answer presented to us by the legislature and by the courts, but what we don't think we ought to live with is just whatever the high-tech community happens to come up next. The step function can get pretty big, and I think that it's fine to think about a step function and some sort of a glamorous battle between poor, innocent computer users and big, mean FBI guys like me. I would be a lot bigger if I were Jim Kalstrom. It seems to me we have to be able to do better than that, that we ought to be able to make decisions about what that step function ought to look like, not just have it step off into infinity, which is, I think, what is happening.
Why does the FBI need a copy of keys to confuse computers, which usually contain keys on hard drives or RAM?
Alan mentioned before that there's an awful lot of information which at one point or another is encrypted but finds its way into the car reservation databases or airline reservation databases, et cetera, in plain text. And yes, indeed, we have a well-understood, well-working method of obtaining access to that information. And I think everyone would agree that's a critical tool for law enforcement. But really, in an important sense, it's real-time access to communications and in some cases to stored data, which is vital to law enforcement activities when it comes to preventing a kidnapping in progress, stopping a drug deal that's happening in real time. It's fine to be able to go and reconstruct 3 weeks later that a drug courier rented a car, but by the time we get access to that information, the drug courier is out of the country and the deal's been done and the drugs are on the street.
It's a fascinating question, and it comes back to this question about the difference between stored information and communications. The fact is, this whole idea of key recovery, the idea of keeping a spare copy of your key, actually falls apart when it has to do with communications. There's very little demand in the marketplace. Well, I there might be some demand in the case of stored data for me to keep a copy of my key so in case with a friend, so in case I forget the key to my diary, I can still recover it. There's very little demand for me to keep a spare copy of a key for an email message that I sent to somebody. If somehow the email message gets lost or the key gets lost, I just send the email message again. I don't really care about keeping a spare copy of a key so that the FBI is able to intercept the communications. It's very rare. So the market, the force for key recovery or any kind of backdoor for communications is completely a law enforcement driven force. And, you know, getting back to, I just add one other point, which is, you know, it's not just about the FBI. The FBI does very good work in the United States, and I think a lot of us are grateful for the work that they do in protecting public safety.
We've got a job for you, Alan.
But we're also very concerned about stuff that happens outside the United States. And the fact is that there are a lot of countries that don't have the same tradition of protection for communications and information from their FBIs. And I think that this is a tool to help people in that context. That's right.
I think one of the issues is, despite that it's protected, sometimes the backdoor built in and we can show you that. I think the whole issue here is with QS built in. It's like you're asking the system to trust the United States government to completely manage our own thing, protected by the length of the process, and enforcing it by the other. What happens if you're like from the King of the Black Hand in 1963? You know, this kind of thing not why the United States government is still in the
And I think both of those comments get to the point that it's not that we really think that people are going to be necessarily doing that. I think some people argue that actually there's a rich history of law enforcement abuses in this country, and there's a lot out there about that. But even independent of that, I think to create a system that is ripe for abuse is to invite abuse. And we don't need to create that system. We shouldn't create that system.
And you don't mind going back from the system of law enforcement.
Well, the status quo has been an evolving thing. 50 years ago, the ability of law enforcement to do wiretapping was dramatically different. For example, it was very expensive, and it traditionally has been very expensive, I think, until recently, to do wiretaps. It cost tens of thousands of dollars. They're difficult to do, involving people sitting out in vans and with wire alligator clips on people's houses and telephone lines. And now, increasingly, law enforcement has demanded the capability to be able to sit in the FBI headquarters in the Hoover Building and tap into the electronic network and do a wiretap with a warm mug of coffee in front of them. And that's I think that's great, but it's not to say that that's the why that status quo and not the status quo of 20 years ago or 50 years ago or 200 years ago. I mean, there's a path here, and I'm saying that the trajectory has changed a bit, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I'm just not quite ready to accept that as absolute truth. The other problem I had with that earlier, when we were using examples of Guatemala and other countries, is I'm not quite sure what the issue of U.S. policy was, our own law enforcement forces, we control, what policies about that have anything to do with Guatemala or Serbia, since they, you know, if they want to use other people's encryption systems that don't have U.S. or the FBI headquarters, so be it.
Well, I'll take the second question first, which is to say, in some way, what we're dealing with is a global medium. So, first of all, the impact of what the U.S. policy is are destined to have a big impact on. The U.S. policy doesn't have a huge impact on the world. It's a world where we all communicate together. So in order to be able to encrypt the message from that I'm sending to somebody overseas, I have to be using the same type of encryption that they're using. And a requirement, an early requirement of these key recovery systems has been that they only work with other key recovery systems. So my encryption in the United States could only work with somebody else who's using a compatible key recovery system. And that is all about figuring out how to drive the entire world market to a place where everybody uses key recovery. The United States government has also been very aggressive at going abroad and trying to persuade our trading allies and other allies to other countries to adopt key recovery themselves. So the U.S. policy is really not just about what happens in the United States. It's about adopting a worldwide key recovery regime where everybody uses key recovery. I got to say, I've never gotten a really good answer from anybody in the government. I've asked this question a lot about what the standard, about what the standards are for keys that are held in third part in countries in other countries outside the United States. I mean, we could have a debate about when the FBI should get access to a key held here, but what what's the standard for keys that are held by the French government? And who else? It's just it's this open question. So I think part of it is I think we should be concerned. I would argue that we should be concerned about what happens abroad, both because I'm interested in a world where people all over the world can take advantage of the promise of the internet that and it's a promise that relies on good security. And also, I think U.S. policy affects global policy affects U.S. policy. It's a global network. I didn't answer your first question, but I'll let Jonathan go on.
We have no desire to be sitting in a room with every one of you. We want to sit in a room with those of you who are under legitimate suspicion of being involved in criminal activity, and in cases where we can convince a detached and neutral magistrate of that fact. So we're not interested in being in everyone's room. We don't have time to be in everyone's room. We don't have the resources to be in everyone's room. But there are some rooms that we need to get into. And it's interesting, we have two ways, essentially, of getting into that proverbial room, of conducting some kind of surveillance on criminal activity. One way is the way that some privacy advocates seem so concerned about. It's through electronic surveillance, whether that be surveillance of the actual telecommunications or whether it be by planting bug devices. And the other way is we can break down the door. And courts are willing to let us do that as well. We can break down the door. We can get into very physical situations in which lots of people's lives become quite endangered. And I think I'm curious to hear from Jonah about whose opinions we're really talking about here, whose values we're really talking about here. Clearly, the companies that are trying to sell this stuff want to be able to do so unfettered. It doesn't cost them anything when some crime down the road happens. Clearly, civil libertarians take a maximalist view of the Fourth Amendment and want to put us at some different point on this alleged step function. Jonah spent a fair amount of time trying to kind of reach out to the net community, whoever that is. Presumably, it's the citizenry of this country, and I think we ought to take a really careful look at just whose interests we're talking about here as this political debate unfolds. Is it the inside the Beltway interest represented by profit motive or ideological motive, or is it really the general views of the people in this country?
It's a good segue. I think that what you've heard here in the last hour is a very good representation of the state of a debate that has gone on at this level without any resolution beyond the point we're at for better than 5 years. And what it's really done is kept a lot of lobbyists employed, and a lot of contributions coming into political candidates' campaign coffers. I don't mean to sound so cynical, because I do think that these are vitally important issues, and I, as Danny said, have spent a lot of time working both on the civil liberties side and now on the on more towards the commercial interest side on this debate. And I think that there has been some recent progress, and maybe we can speak to that as sort of the end point of this discussion about the politics of this issue, because just last week the Clinton administration made an announcement that many believe is a significant improvement in the position, although we have not gotten to the key escrow issues. I think that the sort of simple starting point is to say that the computer and communications industries, again, the Microsofts and the network solutions and, I mean, excuse me, network associates and the AOLs and AT&Ts of the world, are kind of feel like they're in a box. They want to sell technology to a global market. They believe that security and privacy is vitally important to serving that global market, both in terms of real-time communications and also in terms of stored data. I mean, you can imagine a million implications of why security is important. And as Alan said at the beginning of this discussion, the Internet is inherently an insecure place. It was not designed with security in mind. It was designed as a research tool for academics initially by Al Gore. That was a cheap shot, but I just wanted to see if you guys were awake.
That was the best publicity he's gotten, actually, out of that.
And it is true that he deserves some credit, lest I bag on the vice president. But in all seriousness, the industry has tried through supporting its own initiatives and working with the civil liberties community to pursue a legislative strategy to push back against what have been limitations in the law on the export of strong encryption. And I think on there's a long history of cooperation between the industry and the privacy and civil liberties community on technology policy issues that goes back before encryption. But I think that it's actually a very unusual, this debate is very interesting to the extent that the computer industry and the civil liberties community, although there are distinct differences, and I think those differences are tested from time to time, there is a pretty similar interest, and that's partly because the industry realizes that the consumer market doesn't will respond to what the privacy community says. If CDT and the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation come out and say, you know, Microsoft is endangering your privacy, consumers, the market will respond potentially in ways that the companies don't want to see. Yeah, I mean, there are several examples of this happening, and so I think that has driven the industry and the privacy community to work cooperatively, but they also have very different interests. I mean, the bottom line is that although, as I said before, I think that the market has not shown a real desire for mass market key recovery products, in terms of the industry's interests, I think they're much more interested in getting relief on export controls. And just so I say it in case we sort of glossed over this, but until very recently, the U.S. policy was prohibited the export of encryption, technologies with key lengths above 56 bits, which essentially means that I won't go into an explanation of cryptography unless you guys want to know that specifically, because with a bunch of MIT students in the room, I'm going to get killed. the industry has felt and has seen competitive pressure from foreign companies that level of security is not sufficient, and has wanted to push the export controls back. The government has responded by giving a lot of the arguments that Mr. Kallstrom gave to us. And as a result, we have found ourselves going to Congress to try to get Congress to pass legislation to relax the export controls. And we found a great deal of bipartisan support in the Congress. Both Republicans and Democrats, hardcore conservatives and liberals, are supporting the privacy community and the computer and communications industry's efforts to relax export controls on encryption. And we've had a lot of interesting battles along the way, and maybe we want to talk about some of those. But just the broad sketch is that we have found success in Congress in a way that has put pressure on the administration. And each year, it seems, we get to a point where the administration feels that pressure and makes some incremental, modest change in the export controls. And we've just reached one of those points today, last week, where it looks like now they finally have made some significant concessions, although I, being the skeptic and having a lot of scars from this, still don't believe, actually, that much has really changed in the end of the day.
So what happened last week?
Well, there were two things that happened. There's an open debate about whether it was significant or not significant. But the view that says it was significant was that the administration, the White House, finally blinked on this issue, which was the long-standing and hard-fought export controls that we've had. The administration has finally decided that they are willing to liberalize those export controls. And that's something that the civil liberties community and the industry has called for quite, and now the Congress have called for quite a while. And what they said is that they would allow, subject to relatively minimal review, a one-time technical review when you want to export the product, and some record keeping about who the product is sent to, that the administration was going to allow exports of the strongest encryption, virtually unbreakable encryption. If that actually turns out to be the case, and the fact is this was just a policy announcement, there are implementing regulations that get put out for comment, and that'll happen later in December, and we'll really know once we see these regulations. But if that turns out to be the case, that will be an extremely significant change, because it will mean we'll have abandoned the U.S. policy that said we want to keep make sure that people outside the United States don't get strong encryption.
Was that the real reason behind the export controls?
I think that there were two reasons. One was to try to keep people outside the United States from having access to strong encryption, and the second was to try and keep people inside the United States from having access to strong encryption. And the reason the first has something to do with the second is that it's a global medium, and people tend to use and companies tend to distribute products that can be used anywhere on the internet. So in order to be able to communicate with people outside the United States, I'd have to use the same encryption that they're using, so it tends to dumb down the network if you control export.
Now, this is a purely technical implementation question. I remember recently upgrading my desk to 128-bit security, far more secure than 50-bit again. And I did so on my computer, and I came up with a statement that said, do you affirm that you're in the United States right now?
Right.
I said, yes. Was possible. If you type in your name and address and realize that this will be on record somewhere, so I did, and clicked submit, and then they gave me software.
Netscape worked out a deal with the government a couple years ago about this, and I think from a technical side, the way that works is that it does a DNS lookup. It actually checks your domain record and your IP to know that you're in the United States. And I actually had a problem doing that with PGP at mindshare.net because for whatever reason we weren't registered in a way that allowed that system to verify that we were in fact an American company.
Anybody that wanted 128-bit or PGP, software that looks encrypted email, would it really have trouble getting it outside the U.S.?
Well, that's not even where the there's better examples than that. I mean, there are FTP sites all over the net where you can download even stronger encryption than 128-bits. Well,
I would hope that at Harvard Law School we could do better than this. I'm talking Jim now. So there's a little bit of Dan. It's mostly Jim. In all seriousness, we have criminal laws on the books. We have laws against murder. We have laws against drug dealing. We have a variety of laws that do manage to get broken every single day, I'm sorry to say, notwithstanding the best efforts of the law enforcement community. And let's not pretend that the way that this country makes public policy is by only passing perfectly enforceable laws. Let's not pretend that we...
If you walk into a gun dealer, and there's a law on the books that says you can't have a prior record, and you're an outlaw informant that says, I swear I have a prior record, fill in your name and hand it to the guy, at which point he gives you a gun.
We in the industry don't like to equate encryption and guns.
That's right, and that's why when we discuss gun control proposals, we talk about background checks in the law enforcement community. I'm still Jim. Yes, absolutely. We don't believe in.
So you actually mean real background checks. You don't mean fake honor system, right? The export control is supporting honor system.
Listen, the current U.S. policy, which I think we all recognize is very much in flux, is made by through a collective process of a number of agencies with a number of different interests, and to say that we in the law enforcement community always get our way.
Can I just say, it's not quite the honor system, because it's actually had this very unusual effect. The effect has been that there actually are a lot of places all around the world. There's this great demo that folks at Mindshare and the industry people have put together of places around the world where you can get PGP. And there's a great Korean website with these characters and the most PGP. That you can. PGP is a it's called Pretty Good Privacy. It's a it's actually an encryption program that one of the early encryption programs put out into the public domain for people to use. Authored by a group of people, including, but mainly by a guy named Phil Zimmerman, who's become kind of a net folk hero for being sort of under suspicion for a long time by the federal government for doing something.
A different agency.
No, it's important, though. He was under investigation for almost 3 years.
Right.
Because his program, PGP, was posted to the web, actually I think it was to Usenet, and potentially for violating the export controls. Right. Eventually the Justice Department stopped Customs.
He did not look like a man.
Well, he was the perfect guy for the role, frankly. I mean, he was a former anti-war activist and I think liked the celebrity of being in that position, and he was a very good evangelist for the insanity of the export controls, just to the point that you're talking about. I mean, here was a program that he wrote, essentially cooked up in his basement in Colorado Springs, and whether he or somebody else posted it was part of the question in the investigation, but it was posted to the internet, and today still strong versions of it are available worldwide. Now Zimmerman, right. Also, his company was bought by a company named Network Associates, so in addition to doing the rubber chicken circuit, he actually ended up, I think, making a pretty good amount of money off the whole deal.
But doing well by doing good. But there's this board promotion. This stuff is available all over the world, and you can actually find good encryption outside the United States if you look hard. So what does this mean? It means that sort of diligent criminal organizations, sophisticated terrorist organizations, all have access to the strongest. Well, they legally have access to the strongest encryption. The people who don't have access to the strongest encryption are the people who, law-abiding citizens, who use everyday mass market products
And our proposals have consistently advocated a way to give law-abiding citizens better security.
But somehow,
the civil liberties community, in league with the high-tech industry, seems to want to play an all-or-nothing game with everyone's privacy rights, and in fact with the public safety, and somehow want to say, no, we can't do this with key recovery. Oh, all of a sudden, well, we invented this thing called the internet, extraordinary technology, but really we can't make key recovery work. That's much too hard. So really what is happening here is we have this is the kind of thing, in fact, that the FBI is politically smart enough not to ever say, because they get in trouble.
Yeah.
But I think it's an important dynamic in this debate. And now that I'm not as in it as directly, it's easy for me to say it. Bracket for a moment the technical problems about key recovery. That we have done something I think rather odd in that. We may have made the the perfect the enemy of the good here. We may be fighting for a kind of a perfect privacy here, for I'm not quite sure who, and that's why I asked Jonah this question, who's really speaking up about this? I know Alan's speaking up about this, groups whose mission it is to defend the Fourth Amendment, which is a critical function in this society, but only one voice, I would suggest. And we've somehow created a debate where either we go way up that step function, I would argue nearly to infinity, or we keep ourselves locked in a situation where the average internet user, the people who Jonah is so good at contacting, is stuck, as both of these guys have convinced you, with lousy security. Because we're in this political debate trying to get the whole ball of wax.
Let me just jump in and say, you know, this question about our, is it just privacy freaks like me or something who really care about this, and I'd say
that's
that...
That's not a privacy
that's nice of you to say. But the, I don't take that necessarily as a compliment. There are worse. I think, you know, we're setting the ground rules right now for... that's partly what's so interesting about all this internet policy stuff that you guys are going to be studying this semester, is that we're setting the ground rules right now for how much privacy and what kinds of rights people are going to have on the internet as they move their lives online. And I mean, everyday people who aren't even paying attention to this stuff right now. My mom's only getting on the internet, sending me email every day now. You know,
she
doesn't have the PGP yet, but we're working on it. But you know, I think the fact is that I think those people are going to care a lot when they finally start paying attention and thinking about using the internet in the ways that we imagine people actually are going to use it, in ways some of which they're not doing now. And so I do think that there's a broad set of people who care about this. And just to say, you don't have to believe in the privacy step function. All you have to do is think about the world that the FBI would like to create, which is a world which is not the status quo world. It's a world where every stored piece of information and every encrypted communication has a backdoor built into it. That's not the world today. The world today is I can password protect a Microsoft Word file on this laptop of mine and not give the key to anybody. But the world that the FBI is talking about creating is taking a huge step function down. And so the status quo debate is actually very interesting, but the fact is the one thing we will not have is the status quo, almost guaranteed.
So the people wanting
sorry.
No, actually, I'll let it go to questions, because I was going to respond to something that Alan said, but I'll...
Okay. And it, I think there is a medium out there, and the medium is actually sort of where we're headed, which is where actually there's a lot of encryption available, but there's still a lot of opportunities for law enforcement to do its job. I think that people will be using strong encryption. We use it today. I mean, it's available in the United States quite widely. I mean, probably the browsers that you've got on your laptops or that you use in the machines here are 128-bit browsers that let you buy a book at Amazon.com and send your credit card, you know, in a way that nobody, you know, it's basically virtually unbreakable. And the world hasn't come crashing to an end. And I think there will be a happy medium, because what's happening is that the FBI is very wisely now starting to shift its focus away from how do we break the strong encryption and to the question of what do we do about finding the stuff in other ways, you know, getting the plain text when it exists at the end, or finding other ways to break into people's computers. And let me just add that that's the other thing that happened last Thursday, which I didn't say, which is there's two parts to this announcement. Part number one was a change in the export control policy. Part number two was the administration announcing its support for a bill that it's about to send to Congress, laying out the standards on the new legal standards for access to keys and decryption assistance and other kinds of information that is held by third parties. So the idea being, if America Online provides encryption as one of the services, but they happen to keep a copy of the key, a spare copy of the key somewhere, or if I happen to use a key recovery system where I've given somebody else a key, like a bank or something, you know, what are the circumstances under which law enforcement can get access? So, excuse me, what legal standards they have to obey, and the standards that they put forward are standards that are not the full Fourth Amendment probable cause standards that groups like CDT have said should be required for a key. So now we are entering a new phase of this debate where it's not just about export controls, but it's about this other issue, this new bill that's out there about whether, you know, how do you protect keys and what are the legal standards for getting keys.
I just want to take a stab at answering your question. I think one of the things that is that all of us have seen that's unique about the internet is that it's open and that everyone is empowered to be their own person. They're empowered to be a publisher to the world. They're empowered to start a business, to be creative in so many different ways. And one of the challenges in this debate, and I think also the opportunity for everyone, is that it's up to you. I mean, you can't trust the government to protect your privacy. You probably shouldn't trust us, the industry, really all that much either, beyond evaluating whether or not the products that we're offering you to do it satisfy specific criteria that you have. And if you believe that we're in bed with Jim Kallstrom and building back doors into our products, we think as an industry that you're going to be less likely to feel that you can empower yourself. But ultimately, I think it's about individuals all over the world in finding ways to make sure that they feel like their own personal communications, their business communications are secure, and not looking to the government. And potentially also, what Alan was saying about standards, looking to that to say, have we resolved the legal process questions appropriately so that I can feel confident that if I am the subject of investigation to an earlier question, that there is accountability and due process there.
I have a practical question I'm hoping you can help me out with here. I have a bank account at the bank office. And,
account number?
Right.
And you require 128 days to browse not access your account online. Now, I'm going to Madrid, Spain next week, and I downloaded the browser on my computer, on my laptop, and I don't take it.
Well, actually, the answer is yes, but there it falls under something called the personal use exemption within the export regulations that govern encryption right now. And so while it actually is now legal, and it wasn't up until about, I guess, two years ago it would have been illegal for you to do that. In fact, there's a great story about one of the well-known cryptographers, Matt Blaze, talking about his life as an arms courier because he used to travel all over the world and try to see if he could get an exception to take encryption with him on his laptop. But actually, what happens right now is there's something called a personal use exemption. You can take your laptop out of the country, do that, but you are required under these regulations to use certain elements of diligence to make sure that your laptop is never out of your possession or in an insecure place where others could do it, to not give other people access to the encryption or transfer the encryption to other people, foreign nationals outside the United States, and also to keep records of your travel with this encryption for at least up to 7 years. For 7 years, you have to keep records of your travels, where you were, and who had access to your machine. I sense that probably most people who travel abroad don't do that, but I could be wrong.
How about this guy here? I know you can pass the mic on. What I gather from your comments on the announcement of the bill in October is that it sounds like a bit of a surprise. It seems to be a bit of a rollback from what administration was actually doing. So I'd just like to understand from your point of view, what is the real reason for this apparent rollback, because it seems to come as a surprise. So why really did the administration suddenly make a turnaround in policy? That's the first question. Secondly, I was wondering if any of you could offer the real numbers in terms of income that companies would make from this turnaround policy. I mean, could this really, at the end of the day, be an economic driving question in terms of if you come down to the board again?
Let me take a stab at answering your first question and maybe a guess at your second. We have been building to the point of this announcement for a very, very long time, and this is typical of the history of this issue, except that each time it is sort of ratcheted up in significance. Why this week? A bill called the Security and Freedom Through Encryption Act, SAFE, with over 260 co-sponsors, both Republicans and Democrats, and the support of both the Majority Leader Dick Armey and Minority Leader Dick Gephardt. And I have to say, it was one of the strangest Washington experiences I've had, to be at the press conference when this bill was introduced with those guys standing there together. Was about to be debated and most likely passed on the House floor. Its chances of success in the Senate were questionable, I think we'd all agree, and the chances that the FBI and law enforcement were going to be able to amend the bill to address some of Mr. Kallstrom's concerns was also very possible. But it appeared to have significant momentum heading into an election year where the love of the tech industry for either party is something that both parties are seeking to court. And I think that to be sort of cynical in this, I think that the White House was reluctant to have to take a side in a congressional debate, perhaps veto a bill to draw the Republicans into the debate in a way that might cost the vice president some potential support or at least political capital with the tech industry. That may overstate the significance of the political dynamics slightly. I mean, I think you can look at the other side just as well and say that this issue has never really risen to the level of presidential politics and therefore, you know, why act now? But my own analysis of it, and I think Alan probably would agree, is that the threat of passage of a House bill was a significant enough threat to the administration that they felt the need at this stage, before it got too far into a real political season, to make a compromise. Because of that dynamic, though, I, again, personally, I'm skeptical of the real significance of this announcement, because we've been through this before, and we've seen these not quite as significant as this moment, but real progress made, only to be fudged in the implementation regulations. In addition, to throw a bone to Jim Kallstrom and his friends, the bill that Alan was just talking about, which has some real potential privacy problems and potential concerns for the industry, is now been thrown back into Congress. So the debate is not over. I hope that that gets to your
Let me just, since you invoke my name so many times, first of all, I hope you're all my friends. Since I'm a former government official and not part of this administration, I can be a little bit more candid. I think that there are several political dynamics that are worth observing here. I mean, this issue has been recognized by the Clinton administration since day one, essentially, mm-hmm. even day minus one of that administration, as really a kind of a no-win issue for them. And in fact, one former administration official called this the Bosnia of telecommunications politics at a time when that was a more relevant reference. I think it really is, and certainly I can say from the standpoint of the law enforcement community, it's very hard for anyone in the law enforcement community to really step back and take the appropriate long view of this issue, because the day that the law enforcement community supports a compromise on this issue, it opens everyone in that community, particularly people like myself, up to severe criticism when there's the next terrorist incident that has any potential link with encryption in any way. We supported loosening restrictions on this technology, which then got used to, heaven forbid, actually blow up the World Trade Center. That's a political nightmare for everyone from Clinton to Gore mm-hmm. to Janet Reno to the real Jim Kallstrom on down. So it is really, it's an issue that you can on the one hand say, well, it takes a lot of political courage, but I think it's actually fair to say that at some level it takes a lot of political stupidity, politics with a very small p there, to do anything. And I think Joan is right that there have been a number of times over the last couple of years where the administration has been pushed by events to appear to do something. The most notable time was when the House was about to pass legislation the last time at the very beginning of the Clinton administration. Vice President Gore very deftly stopped it by writing what is now known as the Cantwell letter to a member of Congress from Washington State, Maria Cantwell, saying that the administration was committed to making a whole series of changes in encryption policy. And those changes actually look remarkably like the proposal announced by the White House last week. Now, I'm not making any predictions about what this proposal really means or how far it goes or doesn't go, but I think it's hard to point to any legislative issue. I actually can't think of a parallel where there's such a advanced retreat mm-hmm. kind of style going on. But I do think from the law enforcement perspective, if the real Jim Kallstrom were sitting here, I think what he would really say is we can either do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. And the easy way from law enforcement's perspective is to try to work out some kind of technology fix that at least addresses some of law enforcement problems and allows the infrastructure to move forward in a nominally secure fashion. And the hard way, I think, unfortunately, is the real threat of draconian legislation coming out after the next real terrorist incident. I mean, you look at what happened to civil liberties after Oklahoma City in this country, and it was really quite astonishing, the kinds of provisions that were in the crime bill, the counterterrorism provisions that got rushed through in the space of a couple months. And so law enforcement is actually able to take a very long view of these issues and know, unfortunately, that they can rely on that kind of incident to enact the kind of access provisions that Alan is concerned about very quickly. I think that they really would have liked to follow the CALEA model here and just kind of fix the infrastructure. And I think one of the weaknesses that law enforcement has in this arena is that they're really used to dealing with an industry like the telephone industry, which is relatively centralized, has a relatively small number of highly visible, politically accountable, regulated entities who can be told what to do, either legislatively or just under the table. And this is where I think Joan and Alan really make a critical point, that the net, I think, for a lot of wonderful reasons, is simply not like that. And the reason I think you see such extreme reactions in some cases from the law enforcement community is they don't know who to go to solve their problem. They're used to being able to go to pick up the phone and talk to the head of AT&T and say, come on, Bob Allen, fix this problem for us. And when a guy like Jim Kallstrom calls up the former president of AT&T, not the current one, he's going to do what the head of the FBI director says, but Kallstrom or his successor has no one to call, and it's a very, very threatening situation for them to be in.
One other thought, on the political dynamic, is that the pendulum that Danny was talking about how, or excuse me, Kallstrom, I don't know which voice you're listening to, that how it swung in a way that threatened civil liberties in the wake of Oklahoma City swings the other way too. And don't forget that the FBI is embroiled in a controversy right now over its behavior in the Waco situation, which has now bubbled back up and is happening around the time that this announcement was made. And I think that in some indirect way, that plays into the debate.
I think those are both really good comments. And I want to say just two things about why things have changed and why this policy might have happened, if it really has happened, this policy shift. One on the policy aspect and one on the politics. The policy side, I mean, I guess this is something we don't actually like to say in Washington, but it's possible that the policy has actually changed because it was the right thing to do, which is kind of a very unsophisticated view of things, I guess, but at least people don't like to say that inside the Beltway. But the fact is that we've argued for a long time that export controls were basically unsustainable, and we've talked about a lot of reasons why, and I think the biggest piece of it is that you really can't stop an idea at the border. And that encryption is at its heart an idea. I was an MIT undergraduate and took this class 18310, which is an applied math class. I don't know if it still exists now. And one of our assignments was to build basically the basic heart of an encryption engine, a prime number factoring program that is the heart of some of the public key encryption programs. And it was a problem set that we had a week to do, and we all did it. And the fact was that, I mean, these ideas about how to do encryption are not unique to the United States. And the fact is that you can't stop ideas. Encryption export controls were destined to fail in the long run, and now that they have become of very little use, marginal value, maybe it shouldn't be such a surprise that they're being abandoned in some respect, not completely in ways that I wish that weren't there. I mean, you still have to go through this review, this licensing process to export crypto, and there's a whole First Amendment argument there that we haven't gotten into. But let me just say one other quick thing about the policy. The politics of this, which Jonah had mentioned, that, you know, there's this bill moving forward. It's got 258 co-sponsors. To somebody who does spend some of his time working on Capitol Hill trying to explain these issues, that is a staggering thing to say. I mean, I started working on this issue 4 years ago, and the first time the SAFE bill was introduced, there were fewer than 30 co-sponsors. And we spent most of our time, I spent a lot of time talking to people on Capitol Hill, trying to explain to them what encryption was and how the Internet worked. I mean, 4 years, things have changed dramatically. The idea that there are 258 members of Congress who know the word encryption may be frightening to some people who worry about the future of the medium and are concerned about Congress's ability to govern it, to regulate it. But the fact is, it has been a tremendous amount of work to get people on Capitol Hill to understand this issue. Look how long it's taken us to explain it, and I got to say that this is a lot of people would argue that this is a different kind of audience than you find on Capitol Hill generally in terms of intelligence. The fact is that it has been a tremendous amount of work by people, the civil liberties community, but people in the industry as well, to just hold hands and explain to members of Congress how the Internet works and what this whole encryption thing is. And it says something about the politics of the Internet, of Internet issues, that there are now 258 co-sponsors of an encryption bill. It's just a remarkable change in the way that Internet issues are going to be viewed on Capitol Hill now. I think definitely. I think it is a change for the better. I think that educated policymakers tend, even though some people say it'd be better if Washington just ignored the Internet, there are some serious policy issues that are going to need to be dealt with. And I have to be one of those people who think that it actually is better to have educated policymakers.
So, why don't we see other four kinds of comments that actually are still relevant? Anonymous says, you know, I guess people are sort of anonymous, they're not acting today, but not really acting today. I would give a feeling for a set of rules whereby encryption can be widespread and be a constant key act. Individuals or organizations will be compelled to turn over their keys. Now, the imbalance can be struck between the desire for privacy and the desire for law enforcement. Guarantees about the safeguards can be implemented, legal and privacy. The authorization of government can seize the computer, thereby notifying the second party and preventing against the destruction of evidence. Anyone refusing to divulge their keys
of the drug and diet that we have in the church is simply how we can have. Is that different from current policy?
I just got to step out of role and observe there's a little bit of irony in that question being posed anonymously, but that will go on from there.
That actually is pretty close to current law. And the fact is that if you use encryption today, a subpoena can be issued to compel you to turn over not just your encryption keys, but the plain text of your communications if you have them. There's two differences between, I think, you can tell me if I mischaracterize the FBI's position, but I think there's two differences between what the FBI would like and what the current state of affairs does. One is that it's still that kind of standard requires notice be given to the person whose keys are going to be seized. And that doesn't solve the FBI's desire to sometimes be able to get keys in plain text without notice. The other thing is it means that I can choose to not turn over the key and go to jail, the Susan McDougal approach to encryption, or as some people like to say on the internet, you know, they won't get my keys till they pry my cold dead fingers from my keyboard. The fact is that I actually think that this is actually sort of
cold dead fingers from the keyboard.
Is that what I said? Yeah, sorry.
You said
the
keyboard.
Cold dead keyboard,
cold
right.
And dead, not the keyboard.
I think it's actually a part of the Fourth Amendment's protection to the idea that maybe there are going to be times when you feel that things that what's being done is so unjust that you're willing to go to jail rather than turn over your encryption keys, turn over your diary, give evidence, give testimony of a sort that could be required by law. And I actually think that on some level that is one of the Fourth Amendment's protections, is that and maybe the Fifth Amendment's protections as well, that you can go to jail rather than comply with that lawful order.
Now, a quick question would be, what does turning over the keys mean? Turning over the keys might mean, what's my password, right? It's a word that I can utter, that once I utter it, now they've got the way to pass my credit card. So my two things, well, what about the Fifth Amendment? Here are the cops coming after me saying, Mom, what's the password? I want to see the good, and I say, I need the Fifth. So it all been terminated. How does the government do that? Well, turns out the government says, okay, you can have immunity, whether you want it or not. Now you have immunity, you can't possibly be incriminated from being the word, so now you have to give the word. So you give the word. But the immunity only covers the word. It doesn't cover what the word then lets them unlock. So all of the contents they then get to, having given you immunity for the word, are accessible and perfectly convenient in court, falling outside the Fifth Amendment protection. Kind of interesting. I think some of those cases, you know, the side of the expectation of privacy versus your trunk, there's a case that says, no, it's just the word, and the fact that you knew the word, it can't be used against you. If they hold up your drive and rip all your email,
The Justice Department view actually doesn't even quite have to get that far or sound quite that absurd. The view is the view articulated by a number of Justice Department lawyers, I'm not sure whether this is official policy, but I think it's the practice, is that unless you have actually memorized your entire encryption key, which is pretty hard to do, given that they're big numbers, the being required to provide the key is not a testimonial act. It's the equivalent of turning over a record for which you don't have a fifth.
Of course, realize that if I've got a computer and I'm using pretty good privacy on it, if somebody seizes the computer, they can't necessarily get access to my phone. They can't get to it without my password, right? The physical word or phrase I use to unlock.
Right, and the analogy is really to the safe deposit box cases. You can, without any Fifth Amendment concern, you can be required to turn over the physical key. Right. Right. Right.
Virtual key. Yes.
Yeah. My issue is basically, if you have this, I mean, this entire thing logistically, I have holes everywhere. Everything can be very positive and very, I guess, based off the functions that the computing world can always accommodate for what people say can do. And my problem with that is that programs are never perfect. And anyone can tell you that Linux is better than Microsoft Windows, because Linux has the ability to debug it within your backup code. The issue I have right now is just one minor one, and I'm probably going to address it and do an entire topic. But if you were to have an entire key bank, is it possible for a program to create a code that will completely ward it off from any hacker? And the answer is unfortunately no. So how can you guarantee complete security if our bank is basically unsecured?
Go ahead. I mean, I was just going to throw it to Alan. That's one of the most fundamental questions. And the CDT actually, to their great credit, organized a study of 11 of the world's leading cryptographers to ask just that question.
Right.
And the answer was,
well, you can't secure the thing. And that's exactly part of the problem, is that when you build the back door in, when you create the big pile of keys out there, it's very difficult to secure it. I mean, the FBI hasn't even been able to keep its website from being hacked. You know, how do we think that key, you know, this vast new structure where all sorts of third parties hold all of our most sensitive keys is actually going to be secure from attack? And I think what's interesting is that, you know, these keys are going to become very valuable things. I mean, when you move your life online, start doing a lot of your most sensitive transactions, communications, your notes are stored on these online, your whole life moves online, and it's very likely that your encryption key may ultimately become the most important thing that you own. It's the thing that unlocks all of your documents. It's the thing that you use to enter into transactions online, to buy books at Amazon.com, to buy a prescription, to do your banking. You know, so in a world where your encryption key is maybe the most valuable thing that you own, does it make sense that you should have to make a copy of it and put it somewhere where somebody else can get it?
Now, this is a very powerful point. It's one that a lot of students read when they read Howell's article attacking the idea of a four-factor key.
Jonathan, that's actually the paper that Jonah was referring to.
Oh,
yeah, right. It's the same thing.
but realize that part of the answer lies in the title of the program we're talking about, pretty good privacy. And it's not called absolute privacy, it's called pretty good privacy. And just as when you get a club to secure your car, you say, no, we can probably sniff the steering wheel and take the plug out and pull you out. But the car behind you doesn't have the club. And the idea is just to make sure that the car behind you gets it instead of yours rather than yours. So that being the case, so long as you've got any good privacy, you don't start thinking of it in terms of absolute, complete secrecy versus complete plain text openness. But what are all the costs you get in terms of, I know, money? So even in terms of the number of hours it would take laboriously to crack it in order to get the information that is locked up. And be sure it's even designed to be flawed so that at some point in the future, or maybe even the present, among a group of wizards, there is a backdoor that's effortless to use what we think is impenetrable. But for most of us, most of the time, pretty good privacy could mean pretty good privacy. It is exactly why the FBI is confident that they can crack code and have some desire to see who travelers still in. And why it's still a topic of debate which way the code goes, even though you're right. At the end of the day, there's no such thing as unbreakable code or completely open code. Even a completely plain text statement could be misunderstood. Or I can unintentionally encrypt what I'm saying by just being opaque. And then people just can't figure it out. And I even use it. So it's kind of the reverse.
That happens every day.
I was just going to add that I think, you know, that there's a certain subtlety to all of these points that's difficult to try and explain in the context of the average congressional debate. The average congressional debate does not get a chance to really get more than a half an inch deep on a lot of these issues. Congressmen have a lot of things to think about. So, I mean, we're trying to do all of this, and I think this is something that should be of concern to anybody who cares about, you know, how we might set up rules and how governments are going to interact, how we're going to make policy about a new medium as complicated as this. You know, we're operating in this environment of great change where governments and policymakers are going to be called upon to make decisions, judges as well. And we're doing it, and the debate is very complicated. And I think that's really one of the big challenges, and this is a great case study in some ways of the difficulties of political policymaking in the context of this. And while I am now having sort of new hope that maybe we may be moving in the right direction on this issue, I think the sort of the difficulty we've had, and you know, we could, you know, in just trying to explain this to people who don't even necessarily know how to type, literally, it's a real challenge. Well, you know, I mean, like this is, I mean, remember one of the first times that we did the early ancestor of what you guys are doing here with putting all this up was one of the early cybercasts that Jonah put together, the first cybercast of a congressional hearing where we actually had some laptops set up in a congressional hearing room and cybercast it. It was one of the early encryption hearings, and Jonah had this great idea of setting up a chat room and letting people all over the country, all over the world, actually listen in and then sit on a telnet chat session and ask questions of members of Congress. And people thought this, right? People thought this. I mean, the people in the hearing, this is a very cool idea. And some of the members, some of the senators, thought this was actually a pretty cool idea, and sort of came by and sitting over Jonah's shoulder and, you know, looking at the machine, trying to figure it out, and wanted to actually maybe answer a couple of these things. I think it was Senator Ashcroft who said.
Senator Ashcroft and Senator Dorgan. Senator Leahy likes to joke that a lot of his colleagues, here's how he says it, he says they think the PC is a TV that doesn't get C-SPAN.
Right. All of that, of course, you know, now it does.
In fact, too.
So. But, I mean, I just very vividly remember, I think it was Senator Ashcroft sitting down, and he wanted to type a response. And he started, it was like the most awkward hunt and peck type situation. Clearly, this is a guy who, who grew up as a lawyer dictating to people. He never, not only not ever probably really used a computer, he never even had really typed before. And, there's a huge learning curve. And we're still in a very steep part of it when it comes to Congress. I think things have gotten a bit better. And in fact, Senator Ashcroft has become one of the leading champions of good encryption legislation, but it took a little hand-holding.
Let me throw one thing in here. I know we're running out of time, but to that point, I think the Internet itself and the nature of the medium has been an important factor in the education of Congress. I mean, things like that cybercast where we really were able to bring the net up to the Hill, and the whole Commerce Committee showed up at that hearing on a relatively obscure issue because they were going to be on the Internet, and they thought that was cool. We organized, but it had a real significant impact because senators who might not have otherwise cared about this or thought it was important got at least some exposure, and their staff did as well. We organized, we've organized literally hundreds of thousands of people over the years around these issues. They in turn have helped educate their members of Congress and the press, and done things that have generated attention and created a sense of importance and constituency for this issue, which frankly may be bigger than it actually is. But that's for us as advocates against the FBI, a very important element. So I don't know, I mean, obviously this issue wouldn't have existed without the Internet because it's an Internet policy issue, but the nature of the net and the way that citizens can engage on it has had a significant impact in moving it along and raising its profile.
And let me just throw in one other point. I don't know what time you have to end up, but I just want to make an evangelical point here, not just, I mean, part of the evangelism is about trying to brainwash you on the privacy perspective on this issue. But I think the other piece of it is to say, you know, I think that I come out of I have a technical background. I then sort of fell from grace and went to law school. And I can say that now having spent some time in Washington, that there is a desperate need for people who understand technical issues, who feel comfortable talking about complex technical issues, and who also can operate in the policy space. And I think just, you know, by being here in this room, you've indicated that you have some interest in that. And I just say that I think there's a huge need in places like Washington for thoughtful people who can operate in both of those worlds. And the kinds of decisions that are going to be need to be made by policymakers on these very complex issues only going to become more important over time. I think as things like the internet and these other complex technical systems become so much more important in our lives. So I'd encourage you to keep thinking about this stuff because, you know, we need you.
Well, one more piece of cognitive difference before we wrap up and turn to the discussion, which I understand is very damaged, is that right? Well, I can answer your question, meaning some of the questions. So that would be coming just around the corner. And I encourage you, don't ask questions, you meet people you don't know. Actually, seek out somebody who looks like an IT person. If you're an IT person, you know, it's like, wow, real intelligent. The second piece of business is, I'd actually like to take one of the questions that were designed through the rotisserie. If you have a few students aren't joining, yeah, I think students will be in rotisserie. They're not little, they know we'll wait for them. But I want to actually do it in real life questions. If there's some way to pull up the questions, I think that's another page. If you have questions here. Let's just look at question 3A. And I want to do one that I call them the procedure I call the living by fight, because we've already seen, I think, some differences in worldviews between the MIT people and the law people, and I just want to see the dynamic. Question 3 is, as we currently live in a world where the U.S. government, for national security and law enforcement reasons, is an effective arms race to retain and enhance its ability to track increasingly strong cryptography, though the land without its borders. Which of the following two future worlds do you prefer? And you don't have to say why. You only indicate with your hand which you prefer. World number one is the U.S. government has a technical ability to embrace prevailing public crypto schemes and bind yourself to a work requirement that won't do so in its borders without problem without the magistrate signature. Or world number two, the U.S. government cannot readily track common crypto schemes and seems to become routinely adopted for collecting and other data traffic. So first, I want to ask the law students. How many of the law students are in favor of World 1? How many of the law students are in favor of World 2? All right, I'd say it's a majority, but not as much as I can have consensus on point 1. Okay, now how many of my teachers? How many of the MIT people are in favor of World 1?
That's a good job.
How many of the MIT people are in favor of World 2? I would say with a strong consensus on the MIT people in favor of World 2, and
everyone
would agree. So with that said, the other great reward of this evening, aside from wonderful treats that let you from the heart, is the fact that if you so desire, among the law students, you may unsubscribe from the name list.
What is that?
Yeah, what is that? Sounds good.
Why is everyone
happy? You're sending law students. I didn't know if you're serving. How many MIT students? Who gets fewer than 50 emails a day? Okay. This is the problem. You see, the law students all send you the names list. It resulted in a big pile of emails coming to the group to discuss on the law students ICANN. And I invited experts, including the president of ICANN and various other luminaries. You think you might be able to be happy with it?
Well, were they subscribed against their will?
They were spammed by ICANN.
Well, who subscribed?
ICANN spamming Harvard law students? Wow.
Part of the
no, no, no. Who subscribed? Was that a price of entry in the course?
Wow.
They were blessed by the list for a week. They realized they got to stick with it for a week. They were doing some pleasure that the house filtered so that the mail could go into its own convenient bucket called Crash. There is also now an opportunity to unsubscribe from the people. I think some people actually jump in and unsubscribe this afternoon. Some person unsubscribed on Friday. But you may now unsubscribe. I think we can go up on the screen, although there's no way that how to do so. Oh, well, you're not going to know enough. I will send an email out tonight. I encourage you all to be so interested to sign on. Also, please thank Becca Messon, who scribed today. And I
also thank the indulgence of those who tried out our new remote comment system and those who had no opportunity to. We'll see where that goes. And as the other projects, a lot of you volunteers, we're going still to be matching up people to projects that haven't largely happened yet. So with all that said, please let me thank you our four